Here's the story so far. God's people, Israel, are living in exile in Persia. The king, Xerxes, has a shadow mission of impressing people and pursuing pleasure. He's a partying animal, always throwing banquets, lots of drinking. His top official, Haman, has actually set in motion a genocidal plan to annihilate God's people. We've been looking at how all of us have a shadow mission that apart from God, our lives will deteriorate into the pursuit of some unworthy purpose, like comfort or money or approval. In between who we are and who God wants us to be falls the shadow. Meanwhile, a young Jewish girl named Esther has become queen. Her guardian is an important official named Mordecai, and he challenged her that she's got to confront the king and get him to rescind his order. He tells her, "Who knows but what you have come to your position for such a time as this?" And so we've all been looking at our positions, our sphere of influence, because they help us know our mission. And you have a mission from God to be a good friend, a good spouse, a good parent, a good volunteer, a good prayer, a good giver, to volunteer well, to encourage, to do whatever work God has for you to do. So as we go through this talk, I'd like to invite you to think about a really important purpose or mission in your life right now. Might be a job deal, might be something volunteering, but something going on right now. But actually, identifying your mission is the easy part, because then I have to live it out in the face of opposition and problems and inadequacy, and that's what we look at today as we finish the series. So with your mission in mind, we go back to the story. Esther told Mordecai, "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do." It's very interesting. When Esther was trying to become queen, there was no indication in the text that she asked for God's help then. It was very clear the only criteria the king was interested in was that the woman be beautiful and be able to please him, and Esther could do that with her own gifts. But now she's got a mission that's too big for her gifts. Now she needs help. Fasting in the Bible is often combined with prayer because fasting is just an intense reminder of how dependent I am. I can think that I'm self-sufficient. When I go without food, I remember I'm not. So imagine what those 3 days were like for Esther. She would pour out her heart to God over those 3 days. She would reflect on what she was risking. She would imagine what would happen to her people if Haman had his way. She would picture, how shall I approach the king? She'd remember all the times that God had been faithful to Israel before with giants like Abraham and Moses and David. And I find that when I have a difficult assignment, and I have them every day, when I pray it through with God ahead of time, when I get clear about what the goal is, wisdom often comes that would never come if I just tried to do it on my own. The most common prayer in life is one word, help. God loves it when we ask him, help. So whatever you understand your mission that God has given you, don't try to accomplish God's mission without seeking God's help. One more question here. Who are you asking to pray for you these days? See, Esther has all of the Jewish people in Susa pray for her. Not just that, she takes her attendants. These would have been Persian girls. They didn't even know about God. They're not even Jewish. And she has them fast for 3 days and pray as well. On the third day, she returns from fasting and prayer. She puts on her royal robes. She stands in the inner court. She waits for the king. She has explained to Mordecai, it's a capital offense to approach the king uninvited. She is literally risking her life. And I want to pause here for a moment. Always, always, always to pursue God's calling in your life will take courage. To be a good dad will mean disciplining my children and risking they may not like it. They may not like me for a while. To be generous with my money means risking that God really can be trusted, that I really can let go of some of what I have and it'll be okay. A friend of mine knew he had to have an honest conversation with a kind of a Xerxes in his life, and he was scared to death. He was talking to his wife about this on a long walk, and he said, man, I don't want to have this conversation. I don't want to do this confrontation. Every time I think about doing this, my palms get sweaty. They kept talking. About an hour later, he said to her, every time I think about doing this, my mouth gets dry. And she didn't really have the gift of mercy. She said to him, well, then lick your palms. She was a Mordecai in his life. You've come to your position for such a time as this. See, we're all looking for a safe way to pursue our calling. We want a calling, we want a purpose, but we want safety. And there is no safe way. There is no safe way to be great, and there is no great way to be safe. The safe paths have all been taken. Love those words. Mordecai says to Esther, Esther, lick your palms. Now is the moment. She is on an unseen path. The king sees her before him unsummoned. Imagine what's going on in her mind as she waits, this little beauty queen, life or death. And he reaches out his scepter. He invites her, come talk to him. She will live, at least for the moment. And then, not only does he not kill her, he's incredibly generous. What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you. Now that sounds like awesomely good news. Gotta understand, this is king talk for, what do you want today? I'm in a good mood. If you're Esther, you can't take it literally. If she'd have said, hey, great, I'd like half the kingdom, his tune would have changed dramatically. This was kind of along the lines of, would you like to be in charge of the remote control tonight? So Esther cannot blurt out, I'd like to have you revoke the unalterable law of the Medes and the Persians, admit you made a stupid choice, do what your wife tells you to do, and put down your chief of staff. She can't say that. So she says, hey, I'm having a party. Why don't you and Haman come? Now, when your mission involves difficulty, trusting God, praying, and fasting are indispensable. But I want to say this too. They don't substitute for the need for wisdom, the pursuit of wisdom. Esther doesn't just throw up a Hail Mary. She has gained great insight into who she's dealing with. She's going to demonstrate tact and shrewdness and daring that are breathtaking. So as you pursue whatever it is your mission is right now, whatever obstacles you're facing, pray, really serious prayer. Ask other people to pray for you. But then wisdom. I'm amazed how often I and other people will face really difficult tasks and just go into them stupidly. Wisdom is one of the main things to pray for. God actually says in the book of James, if you lack wisdom, ask God. So she does this, gonna have a party. The king is thrilled. Party? Why didn't you say so? I'm there. So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, of course, the king again asked Esther, now, what is your petition? It will be given you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Here's Esther's response. Notice how she words this. It's an amazing story. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question. A follow-up party. Party number two. Son of party. More wine. Of course the king says, yes, I'm there. And notice, he's already pretty much committed to doing what Esther wants because of her shrewd invitation. If you're willing to grant my request, whatever it is, you'll notice I haven't said it yet, then come to my banquet tomorrow, and by coming, you'll be saying yes in advance to my request. Whatever that request might be, you'll notice I haven't said it yet. This little beauty queen is running circles around these guys. And we're ready for the climax of this wonderful story. But the author leaves us in suspense now. Haman, he says, went out from the banquet filled with great joy. Remember that phrase? Because Haman's got this shadow mission, power and ego, and it's going great, great joy. But on his way out, he sees Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Mordecai does not bow down to Haman. Mordecai alone does not show fear to Haman. Look at Haman's response. Calling together all his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them, it's what people with shadow missions do, about his vast wealth, his many sons, all the ways the king had honored him above all the other nobles. And that's not all, Haman said. Wait, there's more. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. He called his wife and his friends together, goes through all of his assets and his liabilities, all of his sons, But all this does me no good because somebody doesn't like me. Imagine being one of his sons. Yeah, I got all these sons. Who cares about them? Mordecai won't bow down to me. It hits Haman because his shadow mission, as it is for so many people, his shadow mission, in a word, is more. More power, more wealth, more control. And more is never enough. This is the miserable nature of life outside the kingdom of God. When you live for more, you discover it's never enough. One of the indicators we're living on a shadow mission is we hand over way too much power to another person. Maybe it's a boss, maybe it's a parent, maybe it's somebody in the circle of friends. I'm miserable because one person doesn't think about me the way that I want or treat me the way that I want, doesn't bow down to me and do me obeisance. That's Haman. So Haman's wife has some advice, and it's this. Why don't you build a gallows 75 feet high and have Mordecai executed on it? And then she says, go to the banquet with great joy. That phrase again. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the poles set up. Meanwhile, same night, king can't sleep. He asks his servants to read to him. King's the king. He doesn't read to himself. You know, he wants them to read a book called The Annals of the King. Guess who it's about? That would be the king. They say, king, what should we read you about? He says, read to me that book about me. And so they do. They read about a time quite a while earlier when Mordecai saved King Xerxes from an assassination plot. And the king's fascinated by this story, and he asks, what honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king wants to make sure everybody in the capital knows that if you save the king's life, good things will happen to you, because the king doesn't want to be assassinated. And his attendants tell him nothing's been done for Mordecai. So the king says, well, something's got to be done. What nobleman around the palace that can help me figure out what to do? And his attendants tell him, well, Haman's here. Haman had just arrived. Of course, Haman knows nothing about the king wanting to honor Mordecai. Haman is coming to get the king's permission to execute Mordecai on his 75-foot-high super gallows. Haman goes to greet the king, and the king says to him, Haman, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now, if you think of the Book of Esther as a play, this next line is like a stage whisper. Now, Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? And if there's ever been a picture of pride going before a fall, this is it. So Haman, who knows he's the man, turns to the king and says, let the man be dressed in a royal robe the king himself has worn. Let the man be placed on a royal horse the king himself has ridden. Place a royal crest on the horse's head. Even the horse gets a crown. Get a noble prince to lead the horse and rider around, shouting, thus it shall be done for. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. The man whom the king wishes to honor. And I guess we all know who that is. Imagine Haman's response when the king says, okay, that's good. The man to honor is Mordecai. Haman, you lead the horse. Good idea. And now things really start moving. They start going downhill real fast for Haman. Esther holds another banquet. The king repeats his offer one more time. What's your request? Even if it's half the kingdom, it'll be granted. And then she tells him her trouble. I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Now, there's a great moment in this drama, too. You'll remember, up until now, King Xerxes did not know who Esther's people were. He did not know that she was Jewish. She is risking everything. There is no great way to be safe. There is no safe way to be great. If I perish, I perish. Esther has died to herself. To follow God's mission for me, I gotta die. She and Haman stand there and wait for the words to come out of the king's mouth that will determine their fate. The king says, who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing. Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this vile Haman. The king is furious. He decides Haman should be executed. One of his servants notes, more irony, that Haman has built a 75-foot gallows to kill Mordecai, and the king says, that'll do. Use it to execute Haman. Now, the success of Esther's mission does not stop there. The king needs a new chief of staff, so he has Esther, the beauty queen, run the search process. Guess who she chooses to be the new chief of staff? So Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. All that wealth and power that Haman loved went to the man he planned to kill. First shall be last shall be first. Esther goes back to the king, reminds him that that old edict means death to the Jews still stands. King says, all righty then, here's my ring. You may write as you please concerning the Jews. Unbelievable story. And in very clever fashion, you can read about this in the book, Mordecai writes an edict that undoes the original. And not only are the Jewish people saved, but we're told that because of these events, get this, many people of other nationalities converted to following the God of Israel. Evangelism begins to happen in an unprecedented way because of this story, because of the beauty queen Esther. I want to note one more irony about a book full of them, because getting personal, before getting personal to close this series. Israel has such unique stories. They were called through Abraham. They wandered in the wilderness. They suffered and fought. And then they had just a brief time, a few generations of living as a country in their own land to be able to give the world this gift of faith in a single, good, all-powerful God. And then they're exiled, suffering and persecution again for centuries. Now, because they suffered so much, they came to love this story of Esther. And some of you will know this. Israel would celebrate the holiday of Purim each year. And there's all kinds of beautiful customs around this. There are four verses of redemption in the book of Esther. Chapter 2, verse 5. Chapter 8, verses 15 and 16. Chapter 10, verse 3. And those four verses will all be read much louder than the rest of the text because they're verses of redemption and hope. Israelites, Jews throughout the centuries at the Festival of Purim would read the book of Esther, and then they would have parades and they would rattle noisemakers. It was such a boisterous and raucous celebration of joy that one ancient rabbi actually said in the Babylonian Talmud, a man is obligated to drink enough wine on Purim that he cannot distinguish blessed be Mordecai from cursed be Ham. Just to be clear, that's not a command in the Bible. That was from an ancient rabbi. So don't actually do that. For centuries from the Middle Ages on in Europe, Jewish communities would have Purim plays where children would boo and hiss at the name of Haman, which occurs scores of times in the book of Esther. So they would blot out his name. They would cheer the name Esther. They don't have those parades. They don't have those plays in Europe anymore. They were ended when another Haman named Hitler designed another genocide called the Holocaust. Only this one happened. Nations have shadow missions. I was thinking this week is 4th of July. Growing up, I had three uncles. My mother's brothers, Hack, Jack, and Mac. I've told you, I know it sounds weird, but they were their real names. And they were all three in World War II. Hack was a radio operator in England. Jack fought with Patton in Italy, and Hack was a tail gunner in the Pacific. My mom's family had a big map through the war, a map of the world with pins in it where, to the best of their knowledge, the boys were. Every night they would listen to the radio to try to find out what was happening. How grateful I was as I was growing up to hear those stories that they fought against the evil, the shadow, the horrible shadow of Hitler. Nations have shadow missions, and that's part of the way we pray for our nation. I think of that line from that great hymn, America, God shed his grace on thee. God mend thine every flaw. God bless our country and save our country from the shadow. I was thinking too, and it's real important for us to understand this, religions have shadow missions. Jesus doesn't, but Christianity as a religion does. I was thinking how ironic it is that this story of Esther is in the book that Christians revere above all others, the Bible. But the anti-Semitism that the Bible condemns so deeply in this story, in this book, Christians over the centuries have very often condoned and even practiced. And we couldn't read this story, this book, without remembering Israel's suffering. And the part that followers of Jesus have often played in that suffering over the centuries. And asking God, God, would you bring peace to Jerusalem and to the Jewish people in our lives that we get to know and love? And forgive us for any kind of remnants of this shadow of anti-Semitism in us. And God, would you help make us agents of the shalom that Israel was created to express? I know the world is so big and you and I are only so small and we're just ordinary people. But so is Esther. I know it's not your fault, but it's your time. I know your little position, your little mission matters far more than you have any idea. Only God understands its significance in eternity. And what I need more than anything else to pursue God's calling on my life, more than wisdom or shrewdness or even courage, is the conviction that it's not just my little life. It's me and God together. It's you and God together. I was surfing a couple weeks ago. There was nobody around in the water. There was nobody at all on the whole beach except this one guy, this giant guy the size of Goliath doing like Taekwondo on the beach. And so I had all the water to myself. I was loving it. After I'd been out there for a while, this little kid comes paddling up to me out of nowhere, a tiny little wisp of a kid. I couldn't believe he was out there by himself. And surfers never do this, but he pulled his tiny little board right up next to me. He was so small, he hardly needed a board. He could have stood up on the ocean on a potato chip. And he's just chatting with me as if we're old friends. He told me his name was Shane. Hi, my name's Shane. What's yours? He asked me how long I'd been surfing. I asked him how long he'd been surfing. He said, 7 years. I said, how old are you? He said, 8. He asked me about my kids, asked me about my family. He said to me, no kidding, he said, what I like about surfing is it makes me feel so peaceful. Little 8-year-old kid. He said, you meet a lot of nice people out surfing. I said, you're a nice guy, Shane. That's why you meet nice people. They just want to be nice to you. We talked for a while longer, and then he said to me, would it be okay if I called you uncle? I said, yeah, that'd be okay. I was ready to adopt this kid by then. Then I asked him, how'd you get here, Shane? He said, my dad takes me. And then he turned around, and he waved at that almost empty beach. And Goliath, doing martial arts, waved back, hi, son. And then I knew why he was so at home in the ocean. Then I knew why he was so at peace and so brave with me. It wasn't his size. It wasn't his skill. It was who was sitting on the beach. What he knew was his dad was always watching him. And his dad was really big. What Shane knew is he wasn't really alone at all. It looked like Israel was all alone, in exile, far from home, no prospect of return. In all the book of Esther, there is no mention of Jerusalem, of Zion, of the temple, nothing about worship, nothing about priests. God is not even mentioned in the book. Esther is the only book in the Bible where the name God never occurs. But he's there. And somehow this little wisp of a girl knew, hey, Mordecai, can I call you uncle? Our little lives, our little missions, our little selves are part of a much bigger mission, part of God's mission. And this is what's going on behind the scenes in the book of Esther. And I want you to see this because I want you to learn to see this in your life. Esther is the only book in the Old Testament that never mentions the word God, but the reality is he's the main character in the story. There is a law that is unalterable. There is a will that will not be turned, but it ain't the law of the Medes and the Persians. How is it that of all the women in the empire, a Jewish girl named Esther becomes queen? How is it that of all the people in the empire, Mordecai is the one who saves the king from an assassination plot? How is it that the king should have insomnia on the very night that Haman built the gallows for Mordecai? How is it that of all the stories, the one that's read to the king was that of Mordecai saving his life? How is it that Haman, the scheming murderer, becomes the victim of his own scheme? How is it that Mordecai, his intended intended victim becomes instead his replacement. How did the king's ring, which was initially given to Haman, end up on Mordecai's finger? How did the noose that was intended for Mordecai end up around Haman's neck? How is it that the people who marked the Jews for destruction are instead themselves destroyed? The writer wants you to know that even in exile, no Jerusalem, no temple, no Sanhedrin, far from home, surrounded by problems, God is right there. Even though in Esther's story, God's name is never spoken, God's heart is never absent. God's arm is never missing. So don't you give up. In your position, however important it may or may not look, however likely your success does or does not appear, whether you feel like your mission is going well or terrible, don't you give up, because it's God at work, not you. Always at work, not you. So often in unseen, unknown, unnamed, unlikely ways, in mangers and crosses, in cubicles and carpools, in startups and in unemployment, across the bay and around the world, with the powerful and the powerless, when I feel strong and gifted, when I feel useless and hopeless and afraid, as once it was true with Esther, so now it is true with you. Who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? It's not your fault, but it's your time.